Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Obama's actions on Monday to limit military-style equipment for police forces, banning some types of heavy weaponry and restricting the availability of other equipment supplied under a Pentagon program. Elizabeth Beavers, the Legislative Associate for Militarism and Civil Liberties at the Friends Committee on National Legislation, who lobbies Congress to end the Pentagon giveaway of military weaponry to America's police forces, joins us. We'll discuss the significance of Obama's executive order and what pushback it is likely to meet. Then we will speak with Dr. John Mueller, the Woody Hayes Chair of National Security at Ohio State University and the author of Terror, Security, and Money, Balancing the Risks, Benefits, and Costs of Homeland Security. He joins us to discuss the millions of false terrorist leads the FBI has tracked down since 9/11 in a futile activity known as chasing ghosts, and why in the most recent so-called terrorist attack attributed to Islamic State in Garland, Texas, the tip-off by the hacktivist group Anonymous to the Garland police 2 days earlier was ignored. Then finally, we'll examine the latest setback by the Iraqi army and Shiite militias with the loss of Ramadi to the self-declared Islamic State. Iraq expert Juan Cole, a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and author of The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East, joins us to discuss why the fall of Ramadi is significant in spite of protestations by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs to the contrary. And joining us now is Elizabeth Beavers, the Legislative Associate for Militarism and Civil Liberties at the Friends Committee on National Legislation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Elizabeth Beavers.
Thanks so much for having me and for covering this issue.
Well, I know that you work on the Hill lobbying Congress all the time, Elizabeth, to try and get this Pentagon equipment off the streets and out of the hands of America's police forces. And for the longest time, you've been fighting the good fight on Capitol Hill. It sounds like at least you've got President Obama's attention, because today in Camden, New Jersey, he ordered restrictions on military gear going to police forces.
That's exactly right. Enormous news today. It is true that we have been pushing very hard on the Hill for Congress to pass the Stop Militarizing Law Enforcement Act. It would do exactly what the president set out today, that it would stop the transfer of the more egregious military-grade items from the Pentagon to law enforcement for free and prohibit the purchase of those items through federally provided grant money. The truth is that this is a congressionally induced program. They authorized the president to do this years and years ago, but it is perfectly within the administration's capability just simply to not transfer the weapons and not to carry out that authority. That is something that we have certainly been calling for, that several members of Congress have been calling for, and we are delighted today to learn that the administration has heard the calls and is taking heed. It's really fantastic news.
So tell us about the Pentagon program, its genesis, who lobbied for it, and why it is that we have, you know, 92,442 small arms given to police, 44,275 night vision devices, 5,235 Humvees, 617 mine-resistant vehicles, and 616 aircraft have been given to federal agencies by this program.
Yeah, those are staggering numbers, aren't they? So this program, well, one of the programs, the main one, the 1033 program is what they call it. And they call it that, it's not very creative, is because it was in Section 1033 of a piece of legislation that passed in 1996. And that put the program into place in its current iteration. The first sort of intent of it was as part of the big war on drugs movement that was happening to crack down on even low-level drug offenses, to arm police, to carry out an almost literal war on drugs. And then in the years after September 11th, as we all know, the U.S. engaged in enormous land wars and expanded militarism across the globe. And predictably, this was funded and supported by defense contractors, and they profited enormously from this boom. And Congress, of course, over-ordered a number of different items and flowed that cash into the defense contractors' pockets, and we ended up with an enormous surplus, and that's what the program allows, is the transfer of surplus military-grade items to police for free, not at low discount or market value, nothing like that, for free. Police have been able to acquire these items, and that's where we see the numbers that you mentioned. It's $5 billion worth, more than $5 billion worth at this point, of weapons that have been transferred through that program alone. And I do want to mention there is also an enormous program in the Department of Homeland Security that got started after September 11th, where they have provided more than $40 billion worth to police, just cash, just to purchase this equipment. So for the administration to say that they're going to reverse these policies and they're going to put a freeze on the transfer and the sending of grant money for these items, it's just enormous, and it's a much-needed reset of something that was put in place long ago.
And again, I'm speaking with Elizabeth Beavis, who's the Legislative Associate for Militarism and Civil Liberties at the Friends Committee on National Legislation. She's been busy lobbying on Capitol Hill for a number of years to stop the Pentagon giveaway of surplus military equipment to America's police forces. And according to what the president said today in restricting military gear going to police, what's being banned are armored vehicles that run on track systems instead of wheels, armed aircraft, ships, or vehicles, firearms or ammunition of 50 caliber or higher, grenade launchers, bayonets, and camouflage uniforms. Now, what's going to happen to all the stuff that's already out there in the hands of police forces?
Yeah, the devil is in the details, as they say. In addition to the items you mentioned there, which are banned from further transfer, there's a longer list of controlled items, which means that they're not completely banned, but they're incredibly difficult to get. Police have to jump through a number of bureaucratic hoops in order to acquire the things on the controlled list, and that does include the mine-resistant, ambush-protected MRAP vehicles that you mentioned, in addition to other machine guns, assault weapons, things that previously they simply just had to submit a quick one-page thing and receive what they asked for. But now it looks like, at least on paper, that it's going to be enormously difficult, if not impossible, for them to acquire these things. We are still hearing that there's some planning going for what do we do with everything that's already out there. As I mentioned, more than $45 billion worth of war weapons are on the streets, are on main streets being used for domestic law enforcement purposes. So in the footnotes of the plan, there's some talk of a potential recall of some of these items. There's some thoughts about that. But there's some accountability standards that are put out, which are mirrored in the legislation we've been working on and some of the calls that some of us activists have been asking for. And I'll say, I really want to mention that one thing that's so striking about this announcement and this executive order is that, you know, what's really captured the conversation in the last year since the tragedies of Ferguson is actually the conversation has kind of gone in the wrong direction. People were sort of lining up behind this idea that, oh, maybe police just need more training. Maybe we just need, you know, body cams. Maybe we need a study done about how these weapons are impacting the criminal justice system, instead of actually asking the question that matters, which is, should they have these items at all? Should these items be overly available from the federal government at all? So by bypassing all these sort of side issues and these distracting red herrings that have been set up, the administration has focused the conversation right back where it needs to be.
Well, in terms of what's still allowed, it's pretty lethal. Aeroplanes, helicopters and drones, wheeled armored vehicles, wheeled tactical vehicles such as Humvees and five-ton trucks, command and control vehicles and explosives and pyrotechnics. Now, in terms of what's been banned, it does, when you just think about it, camouflaged uniforms and bayonets. Now, why would you need bayonets on the streets of America to impale protesters? Why would you need camouflaged uniforms? Police are supposed to be, you know, the boys and girls in blue. They're supposed to be identifiable, not hidden, you know, like snipers in the trees. So how did that mentality get loose in the land? Because there is this Posse Comitatus Act. There's a whole history of in America of not wanting, you know, even the Second Amendment itself says the state shall have well-regulated militias and the citizens' rights to bear arms shall not be infringed. So I'm astounded that it's gotten this far.
Yeah, that's right. And some of these questions you're asking, there's some almost ludicrous answers that I've gotten, at least around the Hill, for, well, even that first one, why do they need bayonets? How can you possibly justify that? And I've heard something as outlandish as, well, they use those to cut seat belts out for people who are trapped in vehicles, or they use it in a funeral procession, or there's any number of stories that have been concocted for what these items are used for. And I think, like anything else, it's kind of useful to tie this in with the same mentality that we've adopted when we think about counterterrorism. We have adopted this perpetual fear mentality where we can drum up any doomsday scenario to justify, well, what if this happens? What if that happens? What if a terror outbreak happens across the main streets of the U.S.? And don't you want police to be armed for that? Or what if this? What if that? Just every situation you can imagine. But that doesn't bear out in the facts, and it doesn't bear out in reality. When we look at how these weapons are actually used in the past few years, since these programs have been in effect, they are used disproportionately against communities of color for over-policing and everyday law enforcement activities, for search warrants, for low-level drug raids, for any number of things that absolutely do not require tank-like vehicles, don't require machine guns, and don't require bayonets. So when we start talking about kind of the justifications we can drum up in our minds, it just doesn't bear out in the facts. And you're absolutely right that what's underlying here is an attitude. It's a perception that the community is not there for the police to protect and to serve, that they are somehow transforming into the enemy that they're meant to fight. And this didn't happen overnight. It came from decades of being told that they're fighting a war on drugs, they're fighting a war on terror. Now, increasingly, we're hearing that they're fighting this war on the border, border security, over-militarization of the border. It's just outlandish the way that we immediately militarize everything. When we're in a state of fear, there's so much that we're willing to give up, and it really does require a hard reset.
Well, my understanding is that it's not just a hardware problem here, and you've made a case for why the idea of calling everything a war has led to this kind of mentality of needing warlike and wartime equipment against the people of the United States. But my understanding is that there's also, in terms of software, not hardware, or psychology, if you will, that what's happening with a lot of the police forces in the country, and it's certainly shown up in Ferguson and Baltimore and other parts of the country, is that the police recruit a lot of vets from Iraq and Afghanistan, which in itself is not a bad thing. They do have discipline training, etc., from the military. But their experience in Iraq and Afghanistan is such that they, whenever they're on patrol, they're in enemy territory, they can't trust any civilians, and they're always, you know, ready to shoot the people. And they look upon the people whose communities they're patrolling as the enemy. And some research has indicated that this holds over to their experience in the United States, and that they sort of, as they go into police in say, African-American communities, this sort of mentality is revisited, and that this has led to a lot of the problems that we've seen explode in the headlines across the country.
Yeah, I think that's a very strong case, and you're absolutely right. I want to always zoom back when we talk about police militarization, and I think it's always important to keep in mind and zoom back that fixing these programs is not going to fix policing. There's a mindset there. There are racial profiling that's happening. There are practices that are taking place that don't depend necessarily on war weapons and on militarized machinery and equipment. There are bigger issues here, and we can't stop short by just addressing the hardware, as you mentioned. But it is such an essential part of the overall puzzle, because it's the slow and steady arming and training and all these things that go along with militarizing the police that have led to where we are now, and that have led to these mentalities that are so dangerous. So the appearance and the capabilities are one aspect, but there's more work to be done. And as you mentioned, there, even with the administration's incredible announcement this morning and their great executive order, it doesn't cover all the bases, and there's still a role there for Congress. And I really want to point out that a new administration could reverse this policy just as quickly as this one put it into place. That's why it's so necessary not to let Congress off the hook here and say this has already been taken care of. They need to codify this into law and make it a permanent change.
So what's the pushback from police forces so far? There is a procedure where they have to justify why they need this equipment as opposed to just having, you know, filling out a form and getting this wish list delivered to your doorstep.
Yeah, so currently it's not much more than just sort of checking a box and nominally kind of filling in your name and saying what you need, checking is it counter-drug, is it counter-terrorism, that sort of thing. These new restrictions are supposed to put in place extra layers and extra protections. But the pushback that we often hear is some of them, you know, are legitimate concerns, like officer safety and some of these other things. And as I mentioned before, these doomsday scenarios of what if this, what if that, don't you want police to be armed for every situation possible? And then we often hear that police are rightly underfunded, rightly say that they are underfunded, and that these programs are what help them get the equipment that they need. So I think it's, again, useful to zoom back and look at the facts. Neither the legislation that we've been promoting or the president's announcement today denies law enforcement of any items that are routinely understood to be suitable for law enforcement purposes. These are enormously egregious items that are on these lists. You read them out before. These are things like drones, things like tanks. These are not items that are commonly understood to be a part of law enforcement practice. It doesn't stop law enforcement from continuing to be eligible for things like office supplies and hardware that's perfectly understandable for law enforcement. My organization is very supportive of the institution of law enforcement. We are pro-officer safety. We are not in any way antagonistic to their true purpose. What we are concerned about is the blurring of the lines between the institutions and the confusion, both in the public perception and in the officer's mentality, that police just quite simply are not military. They have different purposes. They have different needs. They are meant to carry out different functions. So to arm them in the same way not only doesn't make sense, but it sets up a lot of capability of dangerous situations and erosions of important constitutional rights and liberties.
Well, Elizabeth Beavers, you'll be at the UCLA Hammer Forum on tomorrow night, Tuesday at 7:30 p.m. in Westwood. I'm moderating the forum, which is titled The Militarization of America's Police Forces. And joining you will be former Seattle Police Chief Norm Stamper, who now openly regrets the use of military-style policing during the infamous WTO riots of 1999. And so we're going to continue this discussion tomorrow evening, and I'm very grateful that you will be there in person. And I hope our listeners can join us, because I think it's obviously a very timely issue given what the president has just done today.
Yeah, that was an enormous amount of foresight on your part, Ian, to set up this event right when this big news was happening. But I'm so pleased to be participating in the event and to join together with Norm Stamper to continue this conversation. Thanks so much for setting this up.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Elizabeth Beavers.
Thanks so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Elizabeth Beavers, who's the Legislative Associate for Militarism and Civil Liberties at the Friends Committee on National Legislation in Washington, D.C. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into why the tip-off for the latest terrorist attack in Garland, Texas, was ignored.
Come, you masters of war, you that build the big guns, you that build the death planes, you that build all the bombs, you that hide behind walls, you that hide behind discs. I just don't want.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. John Mueller, who's the Woody Hayes Chair of National Security Studies at the Mershon Center for International Security Studies and a professor of both political science and dance at Ohio State University. His books include Atomic Obsession, Nuclear Alarmism from Hiroshima to Al-Qaeda, Terror, Security, and Money, Balancing the Risks, Benefits, and Costs of Homeland Security, and War and Ideas, Selected Essays. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. John Mueller.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And the president today is rolling back the militarization of police, although the cat's pretty much out of the bag with tanks and even MRAPs, mine-resistant vehicles and camouflage and bayonets and assault weapons and machine guns on the streets. And in many ways, it's a part of this psychology or this psychosis that we have in this country where every problem that we have to declare a war on it, whether it's poverty, a war on poverty, drugs, a war on drugs, or the latest one, a war on terror. So is that what happens the minute you decide you're at war, you kind of lose your mind and lose your perspective?
Yeah, we should have a war on calling things wars that aren't actually wars. It's been a, you know, we also had the war on poverty and so forth, so it's a standard sort of litany going way back. And what should be happening more frequently, certainly, is evaluating these wars, so-called, after they've been going for a while, because they start out with a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of money thrown at them. Sometimes they are successful in some respects, and they're almost always unsuccessful in other respects. And what you'd really want to do is have some evaluation over time, and certainly with the war on terror, that simply hasn't happened.
So has anybody done an inventory on how much we've spent on the war on terror and what successes we've had? Because I recently interviewed a former 37-year veteran of the National Security Agency who made a very strong case that in spite of the enormous information gathering of the NSA, where quite often they get information beforehand, including the 9/11 attacks, because they have so much information that they somehow can't collate it correctly, and that in effect, they're really, in spite of the billions that are being spent, there isn't one example that they can point to where they actually stopped a terrorist attack. Have you heard of any time that the government has successfully and credibly put forth an example of a terrorist attack being stopped by the NSA, the FBI, the CIA, or whoever in this country?
Yeah, well, they have stopped plotting. In other words, somebody starts talking about possibly doing something, and so they surveil that, and in some cases, many cases, in most cases, in fact, implant informants, and the talk gets serious and continuous. But in almost all cases, very close to all cases, any kind of weaponry and so forth has been supplied by the FBI itself. So if you count a sort of nascent plotting, they have stopped a lot of those. And always the question is, would these guys, if left to their own devices, ever done much of anything? And the more you look into the cases, the less likely that seems to be the case.
Well, I was struck by the news that during this recent attack, or before this recent attack down in Garland, Texas, where this Islamophobic provocateur, a woman called Pamela Geller, had organized a competition to see who could draw the most insulting cartoon of the Prophet Muhammad and win a $10,000 prize. Apparently, a woman associated with the Anonymous Activist Group, she contacted the Garland, Texas police 2 days before these two hapless jihadis went down there and opened fire on the event with the assault rifles and were promptly killed, supposedly by a traffic cop, but there is a possibility that some of the sharpshooters that had been previously employed by the police and FBI, because they knew this was a red rag waved in front of a bull, this whole event.
Right.
But what I find extraordinary is that the anarchist group Anonymous gave this tip to the Garland police, and somehow they didn't notice it. And they even the Anonymous member put one of the shooter's Twitter accounts in there just to let them know what was happening. And again, they didn't follow it up. So isn't that a pretty extraordinary situation where a group of online anarchists do a better job tracking down terrorists than our own police?
Well, it's mostly after the fact. The FBI, as far as I can see, has followed up over 10 million leads since 9/11, and the number of those that have led to much of anything is extremely small. So almost anything that happens, you're going to find somebody who's tipped them on something or other. And they, you know, like the person you talked to earlier, they're so swamped with this much information. And these huge numbers of tips, vast majority of which basically have no value, they simply can't get to the bottom of the ones that are really valid. In this case, the FBI was following this guy. Had gone back on and started talking about how wonderful ISIS had been, and he'd been arrested a few years ago for lying to the FBI and apparently wanting to go to Somalia to fight and so forth. So he had been on the radar, but he also then had been pretty calm overall, and so they were now watching him again. But if they watch everybody who thinks ISIS is not the world's worst horrible thing, the whole bureau would be following these guys. So they have to pick and choose. And the result of the failure, of course, was the only thing that happened essentially was the two guys got killed, which is probably what would have happened if they'd gone to Somalia as well. So it wasn't as if they carried out a massive attack. They wounded one policeman, but that's the only damage they did.
Well, but that's, you know, you could describe that to luck. I mean, in other words...
Yeah, what you're saying, Ian, basically, is that we should spend 10 times as much money on tracing these guys, because if you wanted to follow up all these 10 million leads, you'd have to spend, rather than $3 billion a year, you'd probably have to spend $30 billion a year tracing these down. They obviously can't, since they've chased down some well over 10 million since 9/11, and hardly any of them have led to much of anything, and when they have led to something, it's usually something fairly trivial. It's exercise in chasing ghosts, which is, by the way, the name of my book that's coming out in the fall, dealing with these surveillance and inspections. In fact, within the FBI, that's their phrase. They call it chasing ghosts. So if you want to follow up every possible lead much more thoroughly, you'd have to massively increase the budget of the FBI to do so. Really careful analysis would have to be made as to whether it's likely to bear much fruit. In this case, what happened was something that was not, you know, was the death of the two perpetrators after they started an attack and the wounding of one policeman. So the fact that they weren't able to disrupt this is tragic in the sense that two people who might not otherwise have died. And one injury, but it's obviously not a major development. So the question is, how many billions of dollars do you want to spend additionally to try to reduce the danger that even this kind of low-grade terrorist incident, in which nobody except a terrorist was killed, would not happen? And so you've got these huge, huge problems all the time. Many of the leads are incredibly trivial. People saying things like, my ex is a terrorist, he's also a communist, he's also a prevert. And the dictum, and it continues to the present day in the FBI, is that lead, no matter how preposterous it sounds, has to be followed up. And obviously you can follow it up over an hour or two or three, or you can follow it up over months or days or weeks or months. And so that's the kind of calculation you have to make. How much is out there? There seems to be very little. The amount of damage that's caused by terrorists is remarkably low. And when they have come up with terrorists or proto-terrorists, they mostly seem to have been delusionary and incompetent, even comically incompetent types overall. So the danger out there is really very limited. And America's chance of being killed by a terrorist is about 1 in 4 million per year. Chance of being killed in an ordinary homicide is more like 1 in 22,000. Chance of being killed in an automobile accident is about 1 in 8,000, not million, but 1,000. If you start after 9/11, the chance of how many Americans have been killed since 9/11, since 2001, your chance of being killed is about 1 in 110 million. So those are the kinds of odds you're dealing with, and the question is, although terrorism is real, although it does commit cause damage and kill people, whether it's really worth these fantastic sums to reduce even lower. And in general, it seems to me that's very questionable. That's kind of work Mark Stewart and I have been doing in their analyses of these procedures.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. John Mueller, who's a Woody Hayes Chair of National Security Studies at the Mershon Center for International Security Studies and a professor of both political science and dance at Ohio State University. His books include Atomic Obsession, Nuclear Alarmism from Hiroshima to Al-Qaeda, Terror, Security, and Money, Balancing the Risk, Benefits, and Costs of Homeland Security, and Wars and Ideas, Selected Essays. And he just mentioned he's working on a new book, Chasing Ghosts, which is the FBI's term for following down these terrorist leads that are largely specious. But I wasn't suggesting so much that we need to spend more waste more money on following these leads, as was the case with the anonymous tip-off to the Garland police that the Garland police somehow ignored. I'm suggesting that maybe the anonymous group itself is somebody that we could hire. Maybe they do a better job. I mean, the fact that this person was with Anonymous, who tracked down this guy who ended up being one of the terrorists, and the fact that apparently on a regular basis, Anonymous keeps tabs on terrorists. They apparently pester them. They apparently take down their Twitter sites of the so-called self-declared Islamic State, and they generally screw with them. And I think, you know, the one thing that you can say about these Islamic State terrorists is they don't have a sense of humor, so they are vulnerable to being both hacked and ridiculed.
Yeah, well, they you know, it's fine if they're doing that. What I need to do is see how much success they've had, given the amount of effort they put into it. The FBI has put in $3 billion worth of effort into this every year since 9/11, pretty much, and the results have been extremely small, and much of it, the vast majority of it, has been essentially chasing ghosts, just running down leads that basically don't go anywhere. The National Security Administration has been sending all these tips. That's one of the big sources of tips toward the FBI. Even the director of the FBI once told the director of the National Security Administration that the information they were getting from the NSA was essentially a useless time suck. In fact, within the FBI, the information is frequently referred to as Pizza Hut leads, because you follow up these telephone connections and eventually you get the guy who's called the Pizza Hut. It's just that there's a fantastic amount of effort going into this. It has come up with very little. In many respects, much of the effort has been done to sort of create terrorists by putting informants among proto-terrorist groups and then essentially bringing them along. It's really, given the limited threat that domestic terrorism presents, the question is, should we really be spending this fantastic amount of money to deal with it when there are an awful lot of other problems, rebuilding bridges and dealing with poverty and crime and so forth that are not being addressed nearly as much as they were?
Well, one of the things that, just to stay with the Garland, Texas incident that was precipitated by this Pamela Geller woman who organized this competition to draw the most insulting cartoon of Muhammad and get a $10,000 prize, and at least the law enforcement people knew that this was a magnet for trouble, and they were down there and they were prepared, and they might well have, the sharpshooters might well have shot these two guys, but what troubled me at the time, John Mueller, was the extent to which the minute that some guy in Syria or Iraq claiming to be a spokesperson of the so-called self-proclaimed Islamic State said, we were behind it all, taking credit for it, suddenly the entire focus of the press was on these two guys who were shot being members of the Islamic State, and this shows their great global reach. The focus completely shifted away from Pamela Geller, who ought to be put in jail for her irresponsible provocation. But, you know, that's the nature of our press, it seems.
Yes, well, they're right. The hyping of the ISIS threat, that somehow it's a threat to the United States, it's obviously a threat if you happen to live where ISIS is engaged, has certainly been massively exaggerated by both the press and certainly by politicians on both sides of the Atlantic, I might say. We've heard ever since last year, it's almost a year now, about how we're going to have all these returnees coming from over there and they're all going to commit violence. We've seen very little evidence of anything like that. In fact, underreported, for example, is that if you join ISIS, the tendency, as you can see from their own website, is to burn your passport. In other words, you're committing yourself to ISIS over there. You don't want, you can't, you reduced enormously your ability to ever come back. In other words, you're changing your life and you're giving your life to ISIS. It's not a matter of being trained and then being coming back. So the whole issue about the returnees, which is bandied about so very much, particularly last summer, is proving to be very hollow. And a lot of that stuff is simply not being considered very much. The very fact that ISIS constantly, has taken credit for something, and then when people look into it, either the press or the police, they'd be perfectly happy to find a connection to ISIS because it'd make good headlines, but they simply can't. These guys may have been inspired by ISIS in some sense, but they haven't been directed or even have any remote connection to it. And so ISIS is taking credit for things which they, you know, it sounds like desperation in many respects. They're taking credit for things that have nothing to do with them whatever except atmospherically. Then the demand also comes, well, we have to get rid of ISIS because it's inspiring these guys. Getting rid of ISIS is perfectly fine as far as I'm concerned. But ISIS is also, but ISIS could inspire people even if it didn't exist. Osama bin Laden is still inspiring people and he's dead. You don't have to be alive and you don't have to be viable to be an inspiration to people. So the idea that if suddenly ISIS is obliterated, that no one will be inspired by their example or by their propaganda is basically absurd. Getting rid of them and taking care of them, wiping, you know, keeping them from their various atrocities and so forth is certainly worthwhile. But the idea that that somehow you can stop them from being an inspiration to an incredibly small number of mostly flakes is really ought to be examined much more carefully.
Well, just in closing, John, really, you brought up Osama bin Laden, and now, just in the context of hype and exaggeration and paranoia and hyperbole over terrorism, now it turns out, according to the reporting by Seymour Hersh, that a lot of what we thought about the raid that killed bin Laden may not be the official story, at least in terms of where the original tip-off came.
Yeah, well, that's extremely controversial, what Hersh said, so I don't know how it's going to come out when we get, really get it examined. But one aspect of bin Laden ought to be considered. Remember when bin Laden was killed, they also brought in all these the computers and all these hard drives and all these floppy disks and so forth, and thumb drives and so forth, filled with what they said was going to be a treasure trove of information about al-Qaeda. They were going to be able to stop plots and so forth. And mostly what they found from it was that al-Qaeda was involved with dodging drone strikes, complaining about it didn't have enough money, and watching a lot of pornography. And the question is, I'm very happy to see bin Laden taken out of action, but it didn't seem that he was doing much in the way of action. Recently, David Ignatius has talked in the Washington Post about some of his last statements and letters, and some of these are now available, have been released, and they're basically the ramblings of a somewhat deluded, aging man, often. He still has started to thought, we still got to do bad things in the United States and so forth, and they don't. The idea that he's commanding anything or anybody in the right mind is listening to his ramblings is very questionable. So ending bin Laden's reign, such as it is fine with me, but it's not at all clear that getting rid of him was much of an advance in any respects because he really didn't seem to have much connection to the real world or even to al-Qaeda's world in the last years, as far as we can see from the evidence there. And no one is going back and saying, what about all that hype? You said we're going to stop all these attacks and we can get really inside al-Qaeda and we find out everything. Name one attack that's been that stopped. Or anything that came out of the bin Laden information. It seems overall there's been basically nothing there at all. Another thing is we've been heard for ever since 9/11 about how al-Qaeda is going to get nuclear weapons. You'd think that some of those little scraps of evidence that there were huge scraps of evidence that they pulled out, some of them, if they had a nuclear program, would indicate some information about it, and apparently nothing is there. So in many respects, it's sort of a Wizard of Oz moment. You capture bin Laden, and basically there's nothing there. The difference between bin Laden and the Wizard of Oz is the Wizard of Oz knew he was a fake, and bin Laden apparently went to his death still thinking he was doing something, and the evidence certainly suggests that he wasn't.
Well, Dr. John Mueller, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. John Mueller, who's the Woody Hayes Chair of National Security Studies at the Mershon Center for National Security Studies and a professor of both political science and dance at Ohio State University. His books include Atomic Obsession, Nuclear Alarmism from Hiroshima to Al-Qaeda, Terror, Security, and Money, Balancing the Risks, Benefits, and Costs of Homeland Security, and War and Ideas, Selected Essays. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back looking into the latest setback by the Iraqi army and Shiite militias with the loss of Ramadi to the self-declared Islamic State. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Juan Cole, who's a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and president of the Global Americana Institute. He's also the author of the blog Inform Comment at juancole.com and the author of The Ayatollahs and Democracy in Iraq, Engaging the Muslim World, and his latest book, The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, Juan Cole.
Hi, Ian.
And I obviously want to talk to you about the fall of Ramadi, which has both, I think, symbolic and military significance, in spite of what the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Martin Dempsey, is saying. But before that, it does seem that Iraq is making its way into the presidential campaigns, and just in the last couple of weeks, Jeb Bush, who's considered something of a front runner on the Republican presidential side, has tied himself up in knots, and so has Marco Rubio. So do you think the ghosts of Iraq will come back to haunt the Republicans?
Well, obviously, those ghosts are already haunting them. Of course, a great deal depends on what happens in Iraq, since the past is always being reconfigured by the present, and the American public is done with Iraq. Once out, doesn't want anything to do with it. But now, with the rise of ISIL, they've become alarmed by it, and I think President Obama was forced to go back in on a bombing campaign against them, as something that even a libertarian like Rand Paul agrees he had to do. So I think the Republicans are in big trouble if they have to justify 2003 all through the campaign. They're in less trouble if the public starts to think that, well, something needs to be done over there.
Well, there was an interesting confrontation between a University of Nevada student, Ivy Zedrick, who challenged Jeb Bush at a town hall meeting in Reno. And Jeb Bush had gotten through basically blaming Obama for the rise of ISIS, saying that he had not overseen the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Iraq, and this young woman said to Jeb Bush, "You stated that ISIS was created because we don't have enough presence, and we've been pulling out of the Middle East. The threat of ISIS was created by the Iraqi coalition authority, which ousted the entire government of Iraq. It was that when 30,000 individuals who were part of the Iraqi military were forced out, they had no employment, they had no income, yet they were left with access to all the same arms and weapons. Your brother created ISIS." And, of course, what did not please Jeb Bush. But it is pretty extraordinary, isn't it, that so far George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, and the neocons have basically escaped the judgment of history on what a calamity they wrought.
Well, I think their name is mud among much of the American public, so it's not as if they skated completely. But as I said, I think that young woman's observation would have a lot of resonances right now, but I'm just urging caution that the public is fickle, and they could change their minds about that.
Yeah, well, the young woman said of Jeb Bush's response, it was like somebody crashing their car and blaming the passenger. But I guess we'll see. Well, let's talk about the latest in Iraq, which is the fall of Ramadi, which is a very key Sunni town. It's where the Sunni awakening that was the source of the so-called surge that allowed Bush and Cheney to extricate themselves from Iraq. Yet, you know, in spite of what seems to be a huge setback yet again for the Iraqi military, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Martin Dempsey, in a press conference with Defense Secretary Ashton Carter, said the city itself is not symbolic in any way. It's not been declared part of the Islamic State Caliphate or central to the future of Iraq, but we want to get it back. The issue here is not brick and mortar. It's about defeating ISIL. So do you think this is a significant setback?
Well, it's a significant step back. If you look at the map, Ramadi is like 60 miles outside Baghdad. So I don't know. It doesn't seem to me like a good sign when a government loses a major provincial capital that's only 60 miles away from the actual capital. It would be like Richmond falling or something in the United States. So the alacrity with which the Iraqi army ran away again is also extremely disturbing. This Ramadi is a largely Sunni Arab city. It's in Al-Anbar, which is a largely Sunni Arab province. It's not the kind of place where the Shiite government of Haider al-Abadi and his predecessor, Nouri al-Maliki, had any fans. And so this is a political problem in part, because you can't raise civil defense forces. The people of Ramadi are not particularly interested in fighting for al-Abadi and the Shiites. And then the Iraqi army is itself extremely corrupt and lacks esprit de corps and apparently can't be bothered to again, defend a territory that is not populated by Shiite Arabs. Most of the army are Shiites from the south. This is bad in so many ways.
So what is going on with these airstrikes that supposedly are taking out the top leadership of the self-declared Islamic State? There were rumors that al-Baghdadi himself had been wounded, although he apparently made a recent appearance. The number two guy is supposed to have been killed, and yet they're taking major Iraqi towns.
Sure. Well, the top guy, the Abu Bakr Baghdadi, he styles himself, may well be badly injured. All that came out was an audio message, so it makes you wonder why couldn't he go on camera. But, you know, the idea that you can destroy this organization with airstrikes and decapitations, as they call them, is silly. And I'll take you back to 2006 when Abu Musab Zarqawi, the then leader of al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia, was killed by a U.S. airstrike. And a lot of observers said, okay, well, the organization is over with. And, ISIL is its direct genealogical descendant. So it's not only not over with, but it now has taken 42% of Iraqi territory. What seems to be going on in ways that I have to say that it's kind of hard for an outsider to discern is that the Obama administration is bombing ISIL positions north of Baghdad and anywhere near Kurdistan, and so is containing it in the north and keeping it from marching south to the capital of Baghdad or due east to the Erbil, the capital of Iraqi Kurdistan. But the reports in the Arabic press suggest that local people in Ramadi and Al-Anbar province in general, local Sunni Arabs who are against ISIL, are complaining that there have been relatively few airstrikes on their side. And so Al-Anbar seems not to be integrated into the aerial campaign strategy. I couldn't tell you why should that be. Some people have suggested that the U.S. wants the government of Haider al-Abadi to be more forthcoming in incorporating Sunni Arab groups into the anti-ISIL force, and that the Shiites have been reluctant to arm the Sunni Arabs, lest they later on become dissidents themselves and threaten the Shiite state. So as a result of the non-cooperation in this regard of the al-Abadi government, the U.S. is not giving it much support in Al-Anbar. That's, you know, something that has been said, but the whole thing doesn't make much sense to me, frankly.
But what does this say about the idea that there's supposed to be this big offensive this summer to kick the Islamic State out of Mosul, which is the key northern city, the second largest city in Iraq? If they've just lost Ramadi, it sounds like the Islamic State is not just holding on or on the defensive. It seems that the opposite is true. They're on the offensive, and they're going to have to now take Ramadi before they can even think about taking Mosul.
Well, the Baghdad government, the Americans, and Kurdistan have some advantages in the north that they don't have in the west. First of all, they have the Kurdish Peshmerga fighters, who, if given close air support, seem to be brave and fight well and acquit themselves well. So they took back, you know, Mount Sinjar, where the Yazidis were being ethnically cleansed from ISIL. Then the Baghdad government was able to take Tikrit to the north. It also took, at least for some time, Beji, the refinery city north of Tikrit. So for various reasons, they seem to have some advantages in pushing back against ISIL in the north that they don't have in the west. In the west, Al-Anbar province is directly connected to the ISIL territories in Syria. It's very solidly Sunni Arab. It's far from the Kurdish population centers. There aren't very many Shiites there. So ISIL, an ISIL victory in Al-Anbar may not tell us that much.
Well, but what does it tell us about the U.S. train and equip effort to rebuild the Iraqi army? And we remember they fled when ISIS first showed up and took Mosul. There have been a couple of efforts to retake territory, and they finally retook Tikrit, but there's nothing there. It's just a pile of rubble, and the expectation is if whatever they take back will end up as a pile of rubble. What do you think, what is the problem with them in terms of their inability to fight the Sunni? I mean, is it the history, the fact that the Sunni really ran the Iraqi military and the Shiites are relatively new? Why aren't they more motivated? You think they're only motivated in taking the Shiite territory, but they don't care about Sunni territory?
That's right. The army has become largely a Shiite army. And most of those guys in it are from Hilla and Basra and Amara, places down south. And they just don't want to be in the Sunni north and west. They're not wanted there. It's an uncomfortable posting. They're in danger of being suicide bombed. It's not their families are not, you know, in danger up there. So, you know, whenever ISIL has made a feint towards attacking or made an attempt to attack Shiite territory, they've actually done all right in defending themselves, the Shiites. But I think they're just, they don't, it's not a national army, and it doesn't perform well outside of its Shiite regions. It has no esprit de corps as a national force, and it doesn't receive any support from local people, and indeed quite the opposite. The local people want them to drop dead and would sooner be allied with maniacs like ISIL than with the Shiites of the south. And so there's just, it's a political problem to some extent. And I don't think that it can be solved purely by military training, although, you know, and military training takes a long time.
Well, it sounds like, you know, on the Republican presidential sweepstakes where there's so many more candidates, and now Senator Lindsey Graham is joining in, and he's sort of does a tag team with John McCain attacking Obama's foreign policy. He's weighing in. Christie weighed in on how on Obama's terrible foreign policy. And, you know, again, they're trying to blame Obama for Iraq, and it just seems historically so counterintuitive. But on the other hand, I guess you're stuck with the war you're stuck with, right? And this one's a mess. And the people that we're supposedly helping don't seem to be able to stop this so-called Islamic State.
Well, of course, Obama got out of Iraq on the timetable set by the Bush administration and under the Status of Forces Agreement negotiated by the Bush administration. So the only possible rap against him is that he didn't sufficiently abandon Bush policies and attempt to force through a different kind of sofa than Bush had succeeded in getting. The fact is that the Status of Forces Agreement would have had no standing in international law, and therefore being in Iraq would be legally dangerous for U.S. commanders and troops. Unless the Iraqi parliament signed off on it, and the Iraqi parliament in 2008, 2009 through 2011 was in no mood to authorize continued U.S. troop presence in Iraq. Now that ISIL has arisen, they've changed their minds to some extent, but there's still big groups like the Sudrists among the Shiites who don't want the U.S. there, who think they can take care of this problem themselves.
Right. Well, you're being factual and logical, Juan, and I doubt whether it'll have much impression on the presidential sweepstakes, but I thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Juan Cole, who's a professor of modern Middle East and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and president of the Global Americana Institute. He's also the author of the blog Inform Comment at juancole.com and the author of The Ayatollahs and Democracy in Iraq, Engaging the Muslim World, and his latest, The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.